This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The world's changing, and what are things we can do to transform our business and engage our fans globally in different ways?
People are using their name and likeness to create more opportunities, more stakes in companies.
In order to turn the organization around, we had to turn it around not only just on the baseball operations side, but on the business operations side.
Football and any other sport is very difficult, but I like to broaden my horizons and be able to expand.
Sports need to be consumed live, and that's a big competitive advantage for intellectual property holders of sports content in the media landscape.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Hello, I'm Michael Barr.
And I'm Mike Lynch.
And I'm Scarlett Fu.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. We are here each and every week with some of the biggest names in sports. This week we sit down with Jake Silverstein. He just became part owner of DC United after exiting a position in the Houston Dynamo earlier this year. He also partners with DC United majority owner Jason Levien and is a co-owner of the Welsh soccer club Swansea City. And he's going to have a lot to talk about with soccer, but we have a lot to talk about also. And let's start, first of all, the latest with the NBA. And it involves now some players now are still saying, look, I don't want to get vaccinated with this COVID shot. And you have others that are coming out and talking about it. But what's more important is, depending on the city that you're in, like in New York, for example, you better be vaccinated, because if you're not, you're not going to be able to play in those games. And that's something that we talked about during the show, and it was in the news with New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
I was asked about Kyrie Irving. I want to talk about this because it's really important for everyone to understand. Our home teams here, they'll be playing the Knicks, the Nets. Obviously, they do fall under the key to NYC requirement. And obviously, the vast majority of players are going out and getting vaccinated. We want all players vaccinated. So I'm a Brooklynite. I'm a Nets fan. I really want to see Kyrie get vaccinated. I want to see the whole team stay healthy and safe the whole season. We have a chance to win the championship for Brooklyn. It's staring us in the face. Let's go get it.
Nice to be a Brooklyn Nets fan, but Scarlett, Kyrie Irving, who says that he is not going to get vaccinated, he won't be playing if under the New York City rules.
He won't be playing in the Brooklyn Nets home games. He wouldn't be playing at away games at MSG, which is also in New York. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't play in San Francisco either when they play the Warriors, because that city has a similar mandate. So you're talking about a big chunk of games that he wouldn't play in if he doesn't get vaccinated. What I find interesting, of course, is that you do have some other big players like LeBron James who are starting to say that they're growing more comfortable with the vaccine to proceed with getting vaccinated. So maybe that is a shift.
And that's the thing, too, is all the players that come to New York, you're not going to play if you are unvaccinated, according to the rules here in the city, Lynchy.
And add Boston to that. Last week, the TD Garden said the same thing, same rules as New York and San Francisco. We remember back in the spring, Roger Goodell, the National Football League, sent out a message to all the players. He said, if you're not vaccinated and you cause a team to forfeit a game, you will forfeit a game pay. And that got everybody's attention. And all of a sudden, the vaccination rate went up very, very high. Now, same rule applies in the NBA. If you're not vaccinated and you don't play, you do not get paid. But I think Adam Silver needs to come out with a similar type of statement right now. And I think that might wake up not only the players, but other people who are dependent on the player's paycheck coming home every other week.
Yeah, the big ecosystem behind the different teams and the league overall. One thing that we should mention before we get a little bit carried away with why certain players are or are not getting vaccinated. Most players have gotten vaccinated, right? Because 2 weeks ago, an NBA spokesperson told ESPN about 85% of the players are vaccinated. The NBA Players Association director Michelle Roberts confirmed that over 90% are fully vaccinated a few days later. So you're comparing that with a nationwide rate of 65% for those who are eligible. So most players by and far are vaccinated. Just as a point of contrast, Barr and Lynchy, the WNBA, which is the Women's National Basketball Association, 99% vaccination rate. How's that?
Well, we all know women are much smarter than men, Scarlett, so that's really comes as no surprise. But it is a startling number, and it's very much equal to the National Hockey League. They're up around 99%, and they're about to start their season. None of the four major sporting leagues, men's sporting leagues, players' associations will allow a mandate. They have rejected it, every single one of them. And that is not going to change. So it's just up to the individuals. And just think of, you know, it can be interpreted as a very selfish move because you're not allowed to sit next to your teammates when you come in. You could be affecting the ushers that are right behind you. You could be affecting the security people that are in the arena, the concession people that are in it. You know, the list goes on and on and on and on. So it's not just a personal decision. Civil disobedience comes with consequences. You can go all the way back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote the book Civil Disobedience. It comes with consequences. And if you don't want to get vaccinated, the consequence could be that you will not play and you will not get paid.
It's a public health issue.
You know who came out and said this? An NBA legend.
Yes.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar came out and said, look, it's irresponsible for these players not to get vaccinated. And he's saying, look, take the shot. Let's go. And to give you an idea, also here in New York City, you can do everything right. And I'm talking about a quick Broadway reference here, Aladdin. The show opens Tuesday. The next day, they have to shut down because they've had breakthrough COVID cases. I mean, it was only reopened now for one day, and that happens. So that's what happens when you do everything right. Now, if you're not vaccinated, I can imagine what the heck is going to happen. Speaking of women being smart.
That's a good theme. I like that one.
My mom, I know she's looking above, is like, oh, how come you haven't mentioned that? Should be the name of the show every dang on week. the NCAA's March Madness basketball brand will now include women. And my thing is, Scarlett, why wasn't this thought of a long time ago?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I guess the way the NCAA defends it is that it was done in conjunction with their contract with CBS and Turner. And so it was a branding thing specifically for that competition. The numbers here, Lynchy and Barr, are what are staggering because the NCAA's contract with CBS Turner for the men's tournament is worth $850 million this year. And of course, that generates the lion's share of the NCAA's roughly $1 billion in annual revenue. As for how much the women's tournament is worth, that and 28 other NCAA championships were sold and were bundled and sold to ESPN, the broadcast rights, for an average of $34 million a year. $850 million versus $34 million. So getting that March Madness branding for the women's basketball will be a big game changer.
We got to get off this thing to some people out there in the listening to us here. It's like, well, the reason why is because the women's basketball doesn't have the high viewership and not as exciting. Enough! I don't want to hear that anymore. It is just as exciting. The ladies can pop the threes just like the men can. It's a great product, Lynchy.
It is a great product. And if you're a pure basketball fan, it is basketball at its purest form. There's very few individual plays in women's basketball. They pass the ball, they run the fast break, they rebound, they box out, they do everything you want to watch. And sometimes the men's game is a little bit boring when it becomes a one-on-one contest or a three-point shooting contest.
Ooh, you said that out loud. I can't believe it.
It's true.
You know, what's also interesting is that initially the Wall Street Journal was reporting on this, and they had asked the NCAA why the women didn't use the March Madness branding. And the explanation originally was that women's basketball leadership at the time chose to pursue their own brand identity. And, you know, some reporting and investigation actually revealed that was not the case at all. You can see inequities between the way women and men college basketball have developed over the years. For instance, women's weightlifting rooms are kind of pathetic and bare, whereas the men get, you know, the best equipment, the best facilities on earth. I thought it was interesting that the NCAA had to hire a law firm to perform a gender equity review of the women's event, which told them exactly what we kind of all suspected, that the NCAA prioritizes Division I men's basketball over everything else in ways that perpetuate gender inequities.
See, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt Lynchy, but I've always said this, I will get hot and heated, and the suits here at Bloomberg is some calm it down, Barr. But I am sick and tired of this women inequality for pay. It makes no blasted sense to me, Lynchy.
Well, what opened everyone's eyes last year? Remember, all the men's games were played in the tournament in Indianapolis, and the women were in San Antonio. And there was a woman, I think she played for Oregon. She took some photos on her phone of the weight room, and it looked like somebody went down to Walmart and bought like four or five dumbbells barbells and just left them on the floor. And then they showed the women, the men's weight room, which was the size of a field house, the size of a football field. Then they showed the meals that they were having. And the men, it was like a smorgasbord. And the women almost looked like they were going through a summer camp. And so that opened everybody's eyes, and that prompted the investigation. And finally, it took something like that to get where we are right now.
I've talked to professional women's hockey players, and they've said similar, that when they go on tournaments, the accommodations they get are comparable, if not worse, than peewee hockey tournaments. They barely get a per diem. They're staying at the worst hotels. They have to bring their own equipment. I mean, they have to do everything on their own, whereas the men's tournament is a completely different picture. The contrast that you just painted, Lynchy, encapsulates it perfectly.
And we have just some time left, but we've got to talk about it. Tom Brady, Lynchy, is going to face his old team, the New England Patriots. Oh, my, that's going to be some good watching this week.
This will be the largest regular season sporting event in the history of Boston sports. And I am not exaggerating. I racked my brain ever since the schedule came out, and nothing even comes close. The local NBC affiliate in Boston usually gets $10,000 for a 30-second spot on Sunday Night Football. This week, they're charging up to $70,000 to $75,000 for a 30-second spot. Nationally, they're going to get $1 million per 30-second spot. They're talking about Super Bowl numbers here in New England. Tom Brady has already, TB12 company, already has T-shirts being sold for $35 that say The Reunion on them, and that's all it has. Every hotel is booked. Every restaurant is booked. FanDuel has already taken, as of Tuesday, had taken over 3,000 bets, and 90% of them have been waged on Tampa Bay. NBC is going to be a very, very happy company come Monday morning when the ratings come in from this game Sunday night.
And Scarlett, I don't know if you had seen the Globe, but there was a picture of a guy on the Globe, and it's a shot of him in a New England jersey, and he's holding up a billboard that says, "Tom, we named our son after you."
Oh my God.
That's how much the New England fan base still loves Tom Brady.
You know, this is going to be a mammoth game, and I can't. It's going to be must-see TV, right? Because everyone wants to see Tom Brady's face, his expression. They want to see Bill Belichick's face and expression when it's under the mask. I mean, there's going to be a lot of armchair psychology going on during the game, and Twitter is going to be on fire.
You know who's going to have the toughest job in this game? It's the director for NBC.
Ooh, yes.
You know, he's going to have a camera locked on Belichick, a camera locked on Brady, a camera locked on Robert Kraft.
You know what? They can't go to commercials.
They can't. they may do what they do in golf. They go side by side. Golf's just playing through. On the right side of the screen is the spot. The left side is what's going on during the delay.
Yeah, when everyone's talking to each other, that's when you get the drama. That's when the stories build. That's when the narratives get formed, right? I mean, we cannot afford to go to commercial. People can't even get up to go to the bathroom.
You know, in TV, we all know this. We call it the money shot, you know? Who's going to come up with the money shot in this game?
Oh, the memes that'll come afterwards, too.
You know, one of the things that intrigues me about soccer is the value of the teams. They just go up and up and up. And this man knows what it's all about. Earlier this week, Jake Silverstein became one of the co-owners of DC United. He previously owned part of the Houston Dynamos and already partners with DC United majority owner Jason Leviatt across the pond in Welsh soccer club Swansea City. Jake, welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
My pleasure. Happy to be here. And always love talking soccer.
Well, let's get started. One of the things I love about it is that these teams, and we were talking about this off air, the team values just keep going up and up and up. Why?
In my view, that's a pretty clear testament to the explosive growth of soccer that we're experiencing in the U.S. The country is finally deeply getting the memo about how amazing this sport is. And I think when you pair that with the excellent business model that MLS has, the really strong ownership around the table, the very strong commissioner with a clear vision for what he wants to build, and everyone rowing the boat together, I think the sky's the limit for MLS. I'm super excited to stay involved in the league.
And as Mike mentioned, Mike Barr, that is, mentioned, you used to own part of Houston Dynamo, and then now you own a piece of DC United. Did you make any money off of that investment in Houston, or is this foray into soccer really a labor of love?
I think the best investments are both, right? We try to make sure that all of the investments that we and our family office make are things that we deeply believe in and take pride in and are personally and emotionally satisfied by participating in. This is no different. The Dynamo investment was a great one. You know, we partnered with another family in 2015 to buy the controlling stake in Houston Dynamo, now Houston Dynamo FC, as well as the Houston Dash, the NWSL club. The last 6 years were an incredible journey. I loved being involved in the league, on the Board of Governors, on several league committees, helping participate in the growth of soccer in the U.S. It was definitely a very good investment. And, you know, going back into the league shortly after the transaction where I exited Houston, I'm really putting my money where my mouth is, that I believe that the future of the league is super bright and there's a lot more room to run from here.
Soccer's been around for a long time, but it's always been one of those great participant sport, but in America, it hasn't been a great spectator sport. But that seems to have changed in the last few years. Just taking a simple look at the increase in value of the LA Galaxy are worth $860 million right now. The average MLS team is worth $550 million. Of course, that's a little bit skewed because of the value of the LA franchise. So why all of a sudden in 2021 is there a surge in value of these teams? I know Michael asked that question. And why are people gravitating towards the sport now after more than 40 years in this country?
So I think there's a lot of reasons. I think in very practical terms, the last 18 months were scary for everyone in pretty much every business. And I think MLS was really out in front in the way we weathered the COVID storm. It was no secret that was hard for the league and for the clubs. But there was very strong leadership and commitment to doing things right. And we got through something very scary as a league. And I think a lot of people have sort of looked around and taken a deep breath and said, wow, these guys, they really know what they're doing. The league is very strong. It's well capitalized. It's well thought through. And if MLS was able to endure the COVID storm as well as it did, that helps de-risk thinking about this from an investment perspective. On the upside, we're going to, you know, the U.S. is co-hosting the World Cup in 2026. The caliber of soccer is getting much better. I'm also a co-owner of a club in the U.K., Swansea City. We play in English Championship, and we're very close to getting back to the Premier League last summer. And I can tell you firsthand, there is a lot of interest from abroad. Talented players want to come experience living in the U.S. and playing in MLS. The caliber of the soccer that we're playing is really very good now.
Wait, do they want to come during their prime, or do they want to come after they've done what they want to do and want to accomplish in Europe and then come here as part of their sunset years?
No, that it is no longer about coming here to sunset and sort of have a grand finale. These are talented guys who are in their prime, who want to know what it's like to live in one of the great American cities, D.C., New York, L.A., Miami, Seattle. They recognize that there are a lot of eyes on the sport, that this is a very serious league that's competing and on a really rapid trajectory of getting better. So it's no longer just, you know, towards the end of the careers, say goodbye, farewell tour, Scarlett. These are guys who are still in the part of their career where they want to prove something. And that's really, that's exciting. I think we're going to have more and more of that over the next 5 to 10 years, too.
I want to talk more about Swansea City because, like you said, you're very close to getting back in the Premier League. What is it like when you own part of Swansea City with the UK soccer market compared to owning a team in the US?
Well, it's very different, but there's probably no project that I'm involved in that's closer to my heart than Swansea City. I was fortunate to spend some time there last month. I'll be back for probably a full month around the holidays with my wife and my young son. That football club is the beating heart of the community in Swansea. It's an amazing place full of really passionate people who absolutely love the Swans. And you know, I've been a sports fan all my life, but the way we engage with sports is a little bit different here in the U.S. You know, to be a part of a club, you know, that goes back 115, 120 years, where I'll have a conversation on the street with someone in Swansea whose great grandfather, you know, took them to games. This is an amazing, unique experience. They are very passionate, very committed, and being part of that journey with the choices we've made, the new manager we've hired, the new sporting director, you know, on the back of an extremely successful season last year that ended at Wembley, you know, in a loss in a game that would have gotten us promoted, it caused us to really look in the mirror and say, what do we want to do here? Do we want to try and keep the band together for one more go-round, or do we want to embark on the hard work of a real values-driven rebuild? We chose the latter. I'm proud that we chose the latter, because I think what we're going to do there is going to be interesting and beautiful and very special. So watch that space.
As you're talking, Jake, I can't help but think of Ted Lasso. the Apple TV.
We hear that a lot.
Yeah, the Apple TV show, of course, where Jason Sudeikis is an American college football coach who does really well with the Wichita State Shockers. Then he is hired to coach AFC Richmond, which is an English soccer team. Are you like Rebecca Welton, the owner of Richmond? I mean, how active of an owner are you in the teams that you own? Are you there making decisions? Are you there being consulted? Or are you working on the investments in your family office most days of the week, like 5 days out of the week, and soccer is something that you can look at 2 days out of the week?
I'm very involved in Swansea. I was less involved in Houston Dynamo when I was an owner there. I'm very involved in Swansea. And that's when I say, you know, it's a project that's as close to my heart as any. Frankly, I'm surprised at how much time and energy and love I've ended up wanting to invest in Swansea. But it's just been, you know, a magical, beautiful journey to be a part of. The folks who are part of the club in every capacity, all from the senior executives to the first team support staff to the custodial staff at the stadium, the ticketing agents, everyone loves this place. And I feel really, really privileged to get to play a part in what we're doing. And the opportunity to undertake this rebuild that's really focused, as I said before, really focused on our values and who do we want to be? What do we want this club to stand for? What do we want the impact on the community locally and you know, at large? What do we want the experience of being a player who comes through the system to mean, and the impact we want that to have on these young men after they leave Swansea to go play elsewhere or to retire or to become coaches themselves? It's been a really fascinating journey from the heart to get to participate.
Do you think
in that
the DC United can similarly build out to have that kind of impact on the local community? I mean, soccer in the U.S., professional sports in the U.S., doesn't quite have that rich history the way that the soccer clubs in the U.K. do.
Yeah, I really do. And that was why the decision for me to exit Houston and join DC came together so easily and beautifully. my partners, Jason Levy and Steve Kaplan in DC United, are my same partners in Swansea City. I know what we're building in Swansea. I know what they want to build in DC. We're at different stages of the journey. In many ways, DC's further ahead, and in some ways, Swansea's further ahead. But the goal in both cases is to build an organization that is uniquely thoughtful, supportive, engaged, coherent, and values-driven, and plays a huge outsized role in the community. It's easy in Swansea. It's a small city where the club is part of the beating heart and fabric of the community for the last 100 years. In D.C., our challenge is a little bit different. There are lots of other games in towns. We're sort of the new sport on the block. But our goal there is to be the leading citizen, I guess, from a sports perspective. We want to be one of the best organizations culturally in the city, not just the best sort of sporting organizations in the city. We aspire to be the place that people want to come work and participate and, you know, be stakeholders, be fans, come to the games, feel what it's like to be part of this. That's our long-term goal. That's a 20, 30-year vision, right? That is not something you do in 3 years, but I'm really, really excited to be part of building it.
Here's another reason, as I was saying about I love DC United, and as I'm reading the press release, the expanded ownership, and that includes multi-platinum musician and record executive Yo Gotti. And I'm thinking of a guy like me who's just taking his Glenn Miller records off the record player, and you're introducing for the younger audience all of these people. What does it mean when you have Yo Gotti in this investment in soccer?
I think this is, you know, this is not a one-off publicity stunt. This is a reflection of DCU's commitment, real commitment to walking the walk around having diverse perspectives at the table. We have, I'm proud to say that we are the most diverse team in MLS from a club perspective in terms of the ownership voices around the table, the senior executives all through the organization. We have a female GM. Our chief executive is a black woman. We are really, really, really trying not to pay lip service to checking a box around diversity, but instead to get the value that comes from having varied perspectives that are not just Jason and Steve and me and, you know, a couple other white Jewish businessmen. We really want to have this be a community asset that represents a super diverse city and a very diverse fan base. And the only way you're able to do that with any integrity or authenticity, in my opinion, is to really include diverse voices. So, you know, that's what I think.
Jake, I love your stadium, Audi Field. 20,000 people. You know, is this the way to go for MLS? It appears to be more intimate than some of these cavernous stadiums like RFK Stadium, playing there with its 40,000 empty seats. But this almost has the feel of an indoor hockey or basketball arena, yet it's outdoors.
Yeah, it's the best. It's great. I'm proud to say I've been to, you know, more than half the stadiums in MLS. In my opinion, with rare exception, the ones that feel the best are the ones that have been designed to reflect where the sport is at, you know, in the U.S. today. Maybe we're not going to have 60,000 people in a stadium, but we will have 20, 25. Of course, you know, the exceptions being Seattle and Atlanta, where they pack their NFL stadiums. The environment at Audi is terrific. The environment at Bank of California, where LAFC plays, is terrific. The environment in Portland is second to none. I personally would much rather be in a soccer-specific stadium that understands how people watch the game and where the supporters section needs to be relative to the rest of it to maximize the experience. and be there with 20,000 people than be in a stadium with 25,000 people that was really designed and oriented for an NFL game. It's meant to hold 70,000. You know, that's not what this is about to me.
And just to follow up with that, where do you stand right now with your partnership with FanDuel? I understand you're going to be able to have a facility inside the stadium or adjacent to it. Is that right?
Yeah, it's part of this. It's part of the stadium. It's one of the innovative things that DC United has done is a sports betting partnership with FanDuel at the stadium. It's terrific.
Heck yeah!
Speaking of innovative, a couple of Premier League team owners wanted to create this European Soccer League not so long ago, and this was just a couple months out of your buying a minority stake in Swansea City. What were your initial thoughts when that first came out?
My phone was blowing up that day with all of my friends in soccer saying, WTF, can you believe this? I don't want to speak disparagingly in any way of other team owners. This is a hard gig, and there are easier ways to make money than to own a professional sports club. That really is the truth. You're forced to be pretty public about your business ventures, and it's easy to be misunderstood. And, you know, everyone wants to second guess and, you know, your intentions and your motivations and who you are as a human being. So with that caveat, it felt tone deaf to me. It felt like it did not speak to or understand what the fans or supporters really want European football to be about. You know, with so many people suffering economically and personally during the last 18 months, it felt like a very clumsy time to unilaterally announce a breakaway Super League. You know, that's just one man's opinion. But
do you think it's gone forever, or are there still remnants of it that could be revived and someone's going to try to make another run for it?
You know, what do I know? I'm not in those rooms. And my view is that there were some elements of the Super League that could have been rational if
like
presented
what?
Differently. You know, the European football is very top-heavy now. It's really tough. You know, it's really tough to compete against clubs where their budget is functionally unlimited. You know, 10 times, 15 times what a smaller club is able to pay. There is an element of frustration, I think, for fans of smaller clubs who recognize that, like, these big trophies are more or less out of their grasp kind of forever. That's not the way it used to be. That's not the way it's meant to be. And that's not really the way it is in U.S. sports, right? Because of the structures and the salary caps and the other things that make the U.S. leagues different from the European leagues, there is a closer tracking towards parity, which can make it, you know, much more engaging for fans of small market clubs. So, you know, I don't have any answers for what the folks at the proposed Super League are thinking or what they may want to do. And I thought it was a terrible tone-deaf idea. I want to be clear. I thought it was a terrible tone-deaf idea. But, you know, I do think that you know, no one really intended to end up in a world where there are only 7 or 8 clubs in the world who have a real shot at winning the Champions League year in and year out. That's not what the Champions League was conceived to be about. It makes for interesting football. Super teams are fascinating and fun to watch. They have global appeal, but there's no denying that you know, it's not as much, you know, March Madness is terrific because you have all these amazing upsets and all of, and you can end up with some really crazy stuff happening. And looking at a Champions League bracket, you know, you can kind of pick who's going to be there at the end. It doesn't take a lot of sophistication to know Bayern and PSG and Man City. They're amazing organizations, but that takes some of the fun out of it to me.
As we start to wrap this up, as we mentioned, you used to be part owner of the Houston Dynamo, and I was just curious about your return on investment. Now, with the three of us and the audience, we're pretty tight-lipped, so we won't give anything away. So if you just want to tell us, we'll keep it down low and keep it quiet. So you can tell us. But did you get any return on investment?
I appreciate the cone of silence that we're all in here, I'm not able to talk in any specifics except to say that we did very well. We did well enough that we decided, really immediately upon exiting Houston, to turn back around and join another MLS club. So that I think ought to speak to how productive the investment was for us, and to our conviction that we want to do this again, in a bigger way for a longer term hold.
I knew you weren't going to talk any business at the dinner table, but I was going to go for the mashed potatoes anyway. So,
okay, great. I'm pretty low carb.
Jake Silverstein, part owner of DC United, also part owner of Swansea City English Football League Championship League. Thank you so much for joining us, Jake.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was a great interview. And if you are not a soccer fan before this interview, you will be after this, Scarlett. He brought out so many points. What did you take away from all of that?
I just kept thinking of the parallels between what he's doing with Ted Lasso. And that's because I'm a big TV fan in general. But Ted Lasso really opened up, I think, a lot of non-soccer fans' eyes on what European football is all about. And you don't really need to understand the game, the beautiful game, in order to understand the dynamics there. One thing I should mention is that Jake is almost like the Diamond Dogs. Lynchy, have you seen Ted Lasso? The Diamond Dogs are the group of people that Lasso gathers to sort out relationship problems within the group. It's Ted Lasso, Coach Beard, Nathan, the equipment manager, and Higgins.
Well, I opted out of Ted Lasso early on, but it's in my bullpen and my bucket list.
He has too many live games he needs to watch. That's why.
I just think that I love that what Jake said also about, because now I'm getting a reference to being hip, along with record executive Yo Gotti, who is also now part of DC United. And I like what Jake said. He's like, look, this isn't a publicity stunt. We're in this for the long haul, and he's in it for the long haul. And I thought that was really cool. Literally.
Yeah, he's a huge soccer fan, self-proclaimed soccer fan. He was first with the Houston Dynamo, now DC United, and now he's got the Swansea City team. And I thought he said something really interesting that I never really thought about. I know people are very passionate about soccer/football overseas. But he said when you go over there, there's no NFL, there's no NBA, there's no National Hockey League, there's no Major League Baseball. Football/soccer is it. And some of these teams have been around for over 100, 125, 150 years. And, the generations of generations have passed it down through their family. And that's something, over here, soccer is like the fifth major sport. Yeah. I thought that was, you're right. I never really thought about it that way.
Soccer is like a religion in Europe. It's your local church.
Yeah. Yeah. Good way to put it.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
Speaking of something that comes here weekly on the show.
Here we go.
I'm gonna go hide in a corner now.
I just love to see their faces. It's time for the number of the week. So this one pertains to something we talked about earlier. This is about the NCAA, March Madness, with the women involved. The NCAA bundled and sold to ESPN the broadcast rights to the women's tournament and 28 other NCAA championships for an average of this amount a year. And Scarlett, I'll start with you.
All right, this conversation happened a while ago, so I can't remember what we had said about it earlier, but I know that since we're talking about this is for women.
This is for women.
It's going to be an embarrassingly small number compared to what it is for men. I'll say it's somewhere in the, I don't know, $50 million a year range.
Lindsay? Tick, 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 tick.
No, you got to sing the Jeopardy song.
Scarlett may have answered this earlier in this program. I'm going to say $34 million a year.
Holy smokes. You, how do you do it, Lindsay?
Well, he got it right on the
he
nose.
He nailed it right on the... How do you do this, man? All three of us, all four of us now with Charlie, we need to go to Vegas. Just come on, Lindsay, let's go.
Yeah, it's like, our golden ticket.
Spin the roulette wheel and let's see. Oh, man, just pick a number, man. You got it going. And see, that's the thing, Scarlett, and you set it up right. It's like it's an embarrassingly low number, and it was $50 million, and it's lower than that.
And I was being generous. Wow, God.
Oh, I can keep going on, and I just, you know, it makes my eyes bug out.
But just as a point of contrast, whether that number was $50 million, what I guessed, or $34 million, what Lynchy got on the nose, the NCAA's contract for the men's tournament is worth $850 million a year.
Exactly. I will get into trouble when I start to get boiled up like this.
Steam is coming out of his ears.
Yeah, it is. It's like, listen. Thank you all for listening. We're having a good time here. This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports. We're here each and every week at the same time. And don't forget, you can check out our podcast page where you can find extended versions of this show as well as our Monday and Wednesday podcasts. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
And I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at Lynchy WCBB.
And I'm Scarlett Fu at Scarlett Fu.
You are listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports and Bloomberg Radio around the world.